Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Parker Wilson. I'm a doctor of clinical psychology and a psychotherapist. I have a private practice in South Denver. At the Denver Tech Center, I do lecture in psychology and counseling at the University of Colorado and also Argosy University. And I'm a practitioner of Vajrayana Buddhism, which is otherwise known as Tibetan Buddhism. And that's what I'm here to talk about today. The title of the talk is Why Buddhism Matters, moving into our new century here. But I'll begin with a story. There was a woman driving very late in the desert, and she spied on the side of the road an old Navajo woman, and she slowed down. The Navajo woman was actually hitchhiking, and she thought she could use the company, and the woman got into the car, and as she was seating herself, she noticed a bottle of wine in between her and the driver. She looked at the bottle of wine and looked up at the driver, and the driver looked at the old Navajo woman and said, "Oh, I got that from my husband." And the old Navajo woman looked down at the bottle of wine and looked back up at the driver and looked out back at the road and said, "Good trade." Okay, so what is the essence of Buddhism? Usually it's described as the Four Noble Truths. So you have the truth that the unenlightened life is suffering, which on the surface of it doesn't seem that meaningful, but we'll delve into it a little bit. Then the truth of the cause of that suffering, the truth of the possibility of the cessation of suffering, that it would be possible to get out of it somehow. And then the fourth noble truth is the path to that cessation of suffering. Also encompassed in all forms of Buddhism is some idea of wisdom, sometimes called emptiness. This is the idea that there is no inherent existence in anything, that all things are composite and are created from causes and conditions, are created conditionally, if you will. And to the extent that we walk around believing somehow that things are permanent, that they are independent, that they exist from their own side inherently, then we were walking around in a state of delusion, what Buddhism would call ignorance. And it's a fundamental ignorance. To the extent that ignorance is present in any of your mental phenomena, your thoughts, your emotions, judgments, opinions, beliefs, so on and so forth, it will also be present in your words, and it will also be present in your actions, and therefore you will suffer. So I've tried to make it as simple as I can. Right? So that would be the wisdom realizing that that's not true. Right? That we are not independent. We do not inherently exist. In fact, we are impermanent. We are constantly changing. We are interdependent. We are relational and contextual. Right, and having deep realizations of this, that there is no witness nor any referent that exists in any inherent way. So you can imagine two minds that are coming from those basic positions, deeply held beliefs, deeply held perspectives from those two positions, would lead radically different lives. Right. So this is the idea of emptiness. A usual thing to help make this clearer would be take the pulpit that I'm speaking from here, or the lectern is a pulpit. It's a pulpit, okay. So take the pulpit. Before it was a pulpit, well, when we look at it, we think that we label it pulpit. And our label somehow has some permanence to it, some solidity to it, like there's some inherent pulpitness in here somewhere, right? And our labels we apply a lot of reality to, and we get like very inherent and kind of permanent about the way we label things. But if you look at it closely, slow down a little bit and look at it more closely. Before it was a pulpit, it was a pile of finished wood on a manufacturer floor somewhere. Before it was finished wood, it was raw lumber. Before it was raw lumber, it was a tree. Before it was a tree, it was a seed on another tree. After it's done being a pulpit, like if I broke it somehow, you know, which I won't do, then it would be trash. Then we would throw it out. Perhaps a homeless person would come by and pick it out of the dumpster and use it for firewood. He would label it firewood. After it's done being firewood, it would be ash. Maybe it would the wind would carry it into a farmer's field, then it would be compost or a part of the soil. Which one of these labels is true? Which one of these labels is inherent, existing from its own side, real, permanent? Right? Of course, none of them are. Or they all are equally, right? Something along these lines. So if you walked around seeing everything in this way, seeing the interdependence and interconnection of everything, you would lead a radically different life. Because according to the Buddha, we are like this pulpit as well. Constantly changing, constantly a state of evolution. Never stationary, never static. Always moving, changing forms. So, if you walked around seeing people and places and things in this way, you would have a radically different perception than we do on a day-to-day basis. Right? Okay, then you have the idea of compassion. In Vajrayana Buddhism, or Tibetan Buddhism, which is a Mahayana tradition, compassion is for all sentient beings. So you do everything with a motivation that will bring good, not just to you, but to all sentient beings on the planet. And not just human beings, but animals and insects and everything that's alive and sentient is basically how it's stated. Everything in this universe and everything in other universes. All living things. Right? So this is the idea of compassion. Compassion is a little bit different than pity. It's a good way to understand compassion is kind of with a frame of reference for pity. You know, I saw this thing one time on Mother Teresa, and there was a guy who was following her around in her convent. And she was dealing with, you know, the worst of the worst. People dying constantly of really horrible things. And this guy couldn't take it after a while. He was with her for 3 or 4 hours, and he just, you know, he had to withdraw and get his head back. And he talked to her afterwards, and he said, how do you do this? You've been doing this for decades, and you do it all day long, and how do you stare into the face of death and suffering and illness and just keep going on? And she said something rather simple, which is, I see the face of Christ in every person that I help. And to me, that's compassion. And it has no difference between her and the person who's suffering. There's very little barrier there, right? So pity, on the other hand, tends to look down on, right? Tends to, it's not eye to eye. It's more like, oh, you poor person down there, let me see what I could possibly do to help you. And it's kind of, it's a little bit self-involved, right? There's some story of, I'm going to be the hero rescuing this person and doing a good thing, and aren't I wonderful kind of feel. So that's a little bit of the difference. We would have PowerPoint slides, but we don't. But if we did, you would see a graphic. It's the three poisons of classical Buddhism. These are said to be the underlying afflicted, disturbing emotions that are present that create suffering. The first is ignorance, which we talked about a bit. The fundamental misapprehension of self. So this idea that you are like there's some inherent Parkerness in here, like a little homunculus somewhere pulling the strings, right? And it will always be that way, forever and ever, right? This eternalistic kind of feel to it. From the Buddha's perspective, this is delusion. There is something underlying everything, but it is consciousness. It is awareness, which is much harder to define and on a much primordial level. My personality and my likes and dislikes and predilections and my emotions and thoughts are really just conditioned factors on top of this consciousness. And it will disappear. It's just a matter of time. Right? So there is ignorance of self, which leads to attachment. The idea of attachment is that the idea of attachment is that we exaggerate and minimize way too much in this life. So, for instance, the usual example I give is a guy, he's going to go down and buy a Jaguar or a Mercedes. Let's say a Mercedes. So he saves up for like 6 months. He works 3 jobs. He gets all of this money together through tremendous effort. Finally goes down to the dealership and he buys this Mercedes. As he's driving off the dealership, he feels high. This is just wonderful. It's like a form of bliss almost, right? And he wants to take it around to his friends and family, wants to show it off, and everybody wants a ride in it, and the girls in the corner are looking at him, right? And it's this kind of wonderful thing. Okay, so fast forward 6 months, and now it's not the new car anymore, and everyone's already been for a ride in it, and you know, no one's really calling to go for a ride anymore. And you know, the new models are about to come out, and it's still cool. It's great, but not as much as it was before. Something's changed. And fast forward another 6 months, and now he's broken down on the side of the I-25, and it's in a snowstorm, and he's late for a meeting, and he's got to call AAA, and cars are rushing by him, and he curses the car. And he's angry at the car. This is attachment. Why did this occur? What shifted here? It's useful to ask. What actually changed? Did the car change? Or was it something in the man? The car is still the same basic piece of steel and chrome and rubber that it was the day he bought it, aside from a few dings and minor changes, right? It's still the same basic piece of machinery. However, the man's emotions about this piece of machinery have shifted radically, right? That's what's changed here. Why was that? Why did it take place? And I assume we can all relate to this kind of example, right? We go through this with people, places, and things in our lives, right? The seven-year itch, you know, whatever example you want to use. Why did this happen? From the Buddhist perspective, it happened because the man invested this object with qualities and characteristics it did not possess and had exaggerated expectations of the object based on these qualities and characteristics that he'd superimposed onto it. When the object, of course, met reality and could not withstand his expectations, emotionally he became very reactive. He became disturbed. He suffered. Right? So that's attachment. So what might he have superimposed onto the object? That the Mercedes had wealth and prestige in it. That it was affluence, right? Almost as if wealth and prestige were like mixed into the steel somehow, right? And he expected this object to produce these qualities. And when it did not, he suffered, right? This is attachment. Ignorance leads to attachment. Attachment leads to wrath, right? Acting out. Anger, right? Which is, anger is like wrath's little brother, really. Wrath has this idea of wanting to harm, wanting to hurt. Tremendous blame, right? So what happens when we feel mental discomfort, afflicted emotions, disturbing emotions? Like irritation, say frustration, anxiety, fear, sadness, depression, grief, loss, shock, loneliness. When these things arise in our minds, we tend to get quite reactive to them. We tend to want to exit. And both as a psychologist and a practitioner of Buddhism, I've seen myself and others exit in three primary ways. The first is to numb out. So this is an idea of like just escaping your own experience because you've judged that your experience is afflicted and you want to get out of it, right? So you'll numb out. So the most overt is drugs and alcohol, of course, but you can numb out with sex or money or work or video games. Or I had a client once who she was seeing me for sexual abuse in her childhood, and her habit was to watch hour upon hour upon hour every day of these endless kind of syrupy novellas on television. That was her numb out. So you can numb out in any number of ways. The second is to become angry, aggressive, wrathful, right? So for anger to sustain itself, it needs an object of blame. So blame would come in here as well, right? So you would blame what's going on inside of you, your internal experience, on something outside of you. And once you have an object of blame, it's quite easy to become aggressive with that object, right? And the last is materialism. Retail therapy is the usual cliche, right? We just want to like buy our way out of suffering. So we want to feel better by buying bigger and better stuff. And more and more, we're as social scientists, we're seeing people getting in a lot of trouble with credit, getting in a lot of trouble with compulsive spending, things like that. It's becoming a problem in our society. So exiting your own experience of life, even if you judge that experience as being afflicted, as being uncomfortable, is not a good idea from the Buddhist perspective. It is as much a part of things as happiness and joy and bliss and boredom and everything else. It should not be avoided. It should be explored. Right? And in fact, the underlying point of all of this is you're creating all of it anyway. You're creating your own reactivity. Because the mind creates its own reality, right? With what we think and believe and perceive and how we frame things, right? We create our feelings and our thoughts. Our thoughts and feelings and judgments and behaviors in turn create our words. Our words typically create actions. And thus the reality of your life is created. So if you're like systematically and habitually and kind of methodically exiting large chunks of your own experience as a human being, you're really missing the point. And not only are you missing the point, you are creating a vast amount of suffering for yourself that doesn't necessarily need to be there. Right? Okay, so that kind of covers some of the basic ideas. The Buddha also talked about suffering that was present for all of us. So this is kind of overt suffering. So this goes back to the first noble truth, that the unenlightened life is suffering. So everyone in this room, no matter what your gender or age or race or religious beliefs or whatever, where you were born, what color your skin is, you will suffer in these ways, and it's very predictable. You've been born, right? Birth is not a particularly pleasant experience for the mother, nor is it for the child. You're born in a state of utter dependence, right? Unable to even lift your own head, to the extent that if you were left to your own devices for any length of time, you would die. Unable to speak and handle your own life in any way, right? It's not a particularly pleasant place to be. You age. So from the moment sperm and ovum come together, we are actually getting older and approaching our deaths. And aging is not particularly fun, right? The market for Botox and plastic surgery is testament enough to our discomfort with aging in our society. And I can tell you from my own experience at 39, my body is a lot different now than it was at 18. Right? I just don't recover as quickly. I get fatigued much more easily. That kind of thing. And that's only going to increase as time moves forward, right? I'll become susceptible to sickness, which is the next one. So from small colds and flus and things like that all the way up to cancer and AIDS and very serious illnesses. If you go into a library, you know, the section on medical pathology is vast. The number of things that can possibly go wrong with the human body, right? And then we have death, of course. There's something we like to avoid thinking about. In Buddhist psychology, in Buddhist practice, death is a common frame of reference. Very common. To remember that things are impermanent, temporary, and that they can be gone like that. To remember that is to make life meaningful from our perspective. To remember that is to be present in the moment. And to be grateful for what is actually present, without engaging in fairy tales about how things will be at some point in the future, right? And how things are going to get better, will get better, how they should be, stories like that, right? You actually stay kind of connected to what's actually going on. So death is a big one because everyone in here will die. And we'll all have people that we love who will face death before we do. And that will bring about grief and loss. In our experience, it's to be expected. It's not to be avoided. It's actually to be embraced, right? Because when we cease fighting our own experience, when we cease making our own mental experience, we cease being antagonistic towards it, like it shouldn't be there and something's wrong and we need to do something about it, then things lighten up a little bit. Then we actually take a deep breath and start having a little fun with things, right? Because we're not so busy fighting. The others are negative circumstances beyond your control. Like if I walked out into the parking lot after we're done here today and was hit by a car. That's not something I wanted to have happen, right? If you would have asked me if I would have liked to be hit by a car today, I would have said, no, I'll skip that one. But it would have happened anyway, and now I've got to deal with that. A negative circumstance beyond my control. Separation from people, places, and things that we want. So I've known a lot of people who want to be famous. I've known a lot of people who just want to be educated. All they want is a college education. And despite their best efforts, circumstances conspired in such a way that they didn't get it. I've known people who just wanted to be loved. They wanted to find that one special person. And again, circumstances conspired in such a way that it didn't happen. Things like that, right? So you just separated from people, places, and things that you want. Then impermanence, the fact that everything is changing all the time. There's no ground under your feet, right? And we like to create a lot of stories about how there's ground under our feet, actually. But when we slow down long enough and take a close look, we see that there's not. Right? There's no guarantee that I'll be alive this afternoon. Right? Let alone a guarantee about anything else. And in fact, everything that comes into existence has created its own destruction by its very existence. This earth will someday be engulfed by the sun. Right? The sun itself will die at one point. I think the last estimate I heard was about 5 billion years from now. But it will. Right? So everything constantly shifting and changing, arising and falling away. This is the way of things. And then karma, as our speaker mentioned, cause and effect. And the fact that we don't know that this is the way things are. We're misperceiving it. Again, that fundamental ignorance, right? We're not connected to the way reality truly presents, that it is impermanent, interdependent, constantly changing and in flux. We think of things as being permanent, independent. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, boy, right? And make yourself into something kind of attitude, right? Which is fine, but when that goes to really deep metaphysical levels in the mind, it starts to not be so great anymore. That was the Buddhist perspective, right? So that we end up living on a lot of fairy tales. We end up living on a lot of misperceptions, misapprehensions, he called them. And through these misapprehensions, especially about who we are, we suffer. We bring about tremendous suffering, mostly through attachment and wrath, and then the overt sufferings that we just talked about, birth, aging, sickness, death, and so on, right? It's very easy to get very angry in this life if you're not careful. It's very easy to get bitter. And so Buddha's teachings advise us to be careful, to consider, to analyze, to slow down, to stay connected, to look closely at what your experience actually is. So, if we do a lot of that, like numbing out from our own experience and getting angry and aggressive and materialistic, we will develop afflicted emotions. The usual ones are sloth and greed and envy and pride, wrath, of course, right? The usual list of the Judeo-Christian 7 deadly sins, right? We'll develop a lot of this emotionality, and we'll get very fixated on mundane things. We want to gain material, and we want to avoid losing material. We want to gain acceptance, and we want to avoid rejection, right? We want to gain praise, and we want to avoid blame. We want to gain nice sensory input, nice sights and sounds and environments for ourselves, and we want to avoid ones that are not so nice. Our lives can start to become consumed with these concerns, all with the underlying afflicted emotions of like greed and pride and sloth and gluttony and whatever, constantly in this habit of exiting our own experience. It becomes a habit. You just react. So loneliness arises, and you've got to do something to counteract it, right? You've got to do something to create a counterforce to that. You've got to escape it somehow. This can become a very strong habit. And to the extent that that's a habit, you're split off from your own experience and fragmented. Such a state of mind cannot possibly yield happiness, awareness, insight, clarity, balance. Simply not possible. This is the Buddha's logical proclamation to all of us. Right? So it would serve our needs to actually slow down. One of the main tools he gave us for doing that is mindfulness. So it represents the courage to stay with your experience as it is, from moment to moment. It represents learning to stay. with what's actually going on in your mind at any given point in time, whether it's grief, loss, loneliness, frustration, irritation, or happiness, bliss, feeling joy, feeling compassion, right? Or neutral emotions like boredom. Whatever it is that is going on, it is utterly welcome, and you are utterly honest and open and willing to stay with it. So let it be present. Once that willingness is present, that mindfulness is present, it is possible to learn to work with your emotions, to work with your thoughts and emotions and judgments and opinions and beliefs, and learn to transform your mind. So the Buddha had very specific methodologies about how to cultivate mindfulness. And you can start working with attachment. You can start working with your ignorance of self, right? You can start getting down to some very deep levels, start opening them up, start exposing them to some sunlight, start exposing them to some analysis. You can begin to change them. You can begin to kind of like soften up the ground a little bit, to loosen things up a little bit. And you can start to breathe a little better, psychologically speaking. Right? And you can actually start to create some happiness and psychological flourishing. These things are possible to do. So in talking about cultivating mindfulness, which we're going to have a little brief workshop after the service today, and I'll just go over a couple of the most fundamental techniques of cultivating formal mindfulness. There are formal methods, which we'll go over for those of you who are going to stay. And then there are informal methods. Informally cultivating mindfulness is usually done with like a raisin. So like I would usually like pass out a raisin, but because my talk is so short, I don't have time for it. But I would give everybody in the audience a raisin, and I would ask you to like take kind of a handful and just chomp them down, and then I would ask you to take one and really look at it, and then really smell it, and then really feel it, right? And then really just put it in your mouth and let it sit in your mouth without chewing it, which is harder than it sounds. Right? And then to chew it 50 times before swallowing it. Right? And to really like connect with the visceral experience of the raisin. Right? This is the difference between our usual go-go lives and mindfulness. Being connected to our own experience of things. Right? So other ways to cultivate informal mindfulness. And again, the formal stuff we'll go over in a few minutes, I assume. The informal stuff is every time you see the color red in your day-to-day life, just going about the rest of the day and tomorrow and whatever, every time you see the color red, introspect. Introspect is a big fancy word which just means to look into yourself. What am I thinking and feeling right now in this moment? That's it. So you just look into yourself. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And then you move on with the day. If every time you saw the color red, you introspected in such a way, it would be useful. Now, it would be useful. It wouldn't be useful if you did that 50 times, because then you probably wouldn't get a feel for things and there would be no pattern developed. If you did that 5,000 times or 10,000 times over the course of the next year, so every time you saw the color red, just for a couple seconds, just check in. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? You're not looking for anything. It's no big exploration. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? A lot of times emotions are going on in the body, too. You identify tension and anger and tightness and whatever, right? If you did that 5,000 times, you would start to get a sense for how your mind works. You would start to see. You'd start to see patterns in when you feel things, how you feel things, right? It would start to kind of string together. You'd start connecting some dots. Another good exercise, which is one I do, is every time you see a stranger walking towards you, like next time you're in the store and you see a stranger walking towards you down one of the aisles, right? Introspect. Ask yourself what you're thinking and feeling about this person. You'll see all kinds of little weird stuff, right? Like weird attractions or repulsions to people, stories that you're telling about this person, judgments and opinions that you have. You don't even know this person. It's the first time you've ever seen them in your life. You'll see all of this mental activity, right, about this object that's a stimulus in your visual field. And it'll be rather elaborate sometimes, right? Like weird, intense reactions to things once in a while, right? And you'll start to ask yourself questions, perhaps, like, why is it like this? And you'll start to notice how you normally just believe in the reality of the stories and the judgments and the opinions that you have about this person. And you let that dictate your interactions with them. or not, right? No interactions with them. It'll be interesting. So if you just did those two simple things, every time you see the color red, introspect. Every time you see a stranger in a supermarket, introspect. And see what's going on. So for anyone who might be more interested in these topics, this is quite short. I did do an extended seminar last year. It's available on my own website. It's www.amidenver.com. And now I talk about Buddhist psychology, and we get in depth with mindfulness techniques and things like that.
Would you repeat that?
My website?
Yes.
It's www.amidenver.com.
Yeah.
Say again?
AMIDenver, all one word.
And that's it. It was a pleasure to speak today. Thank you for having me.